You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I'll be covering the case of Kathy Moulton. Kathy Moulton was just 16 years old in September 24th, 1971, when she suddenly vanished on a trip to a local store to pick up supplies for her evening plans in Portland, Maine. What happened? Where did she go? This is the longest unsolved missing person case in Maine, and 50 years later, her family is still seeking answers, and they aren't giving up anytime soon. Kathy Marie Moulton, born June 28, 1955, was the firstborn of three daughters. She had two younger sisters, Pamela and Kimberly. Her mother, Claire, was an emergency room nurse until she came home to raise Kathy's younger siblings. Her father, Lyman, who everyone called Roy, was a second-generation owner of a service center and car sales lot. Kathy had a family that made sure they ate dinner together every night at 6 p.m. She was close with her sisters and often spent her hours after school chatting with her mom. It seems like her family was very close and made an effort to spend as much time together as they could. Kathy was an intelligent girl who wrote poetry, loved to dance, made her own clothes, and was just the friendly girl next door. She would babysit kids in the neighborhood to earn money and also check in on her elderly neighbors. As Kathy got into her high school years, she began to become more and more independent and finding her own style and personality. She began wearing more makeup, keeping secrets with her sisters, and sneaking cigarettes. Kathy and a friend started hanging out at a coffee shop near Longfellow, and that is where she would meet a man named Chris Church. He was a photographer who asked her to pose for portraits in his Monument Square studio, which she agreed to do. Not sure exactly what age, but either 15 or 16, Kathy was dating a man named Lester Everett, who was 22. At the time, Kathy's parents had no knowledge she was dating Lester. I don't have any information on how long they were dating or any information on Lester's life or background. The summer before Kathy would vanish, her family would travel the continental United States together for 81 days. They traveled in the family Cadillac, stopping at roadside motels at night. Kathy kept a journal detailing every day of this trip with her family. Kim, her middle sister, said it was a marvelous family trip that brought everyone closer together. Kathy would celebrate her 16th birthday on this road trip with her family. The family would decide to celebrate Kathy's birthday in Williamsburg, Virginia. They stopped and had pizza and sang happy birthday to Kathy as they ate raspberry coconut layered cake for dessert. When the family arrived in Texas in July, just a few days later, Kathy would pick out a tan and brown reversible tooled leather handbag as her birthday gift. Kathy was attending Deering High School in Portland and would be starting her junior year just 2 days after the family returned from their road trip. The night Kathy vanished was a Friday night. Kathy had planned to attend the dance at the YWCA and had made a skirt to wear that night, but she needed thread to hem it and pantyhose to finish getting ready for the night. Kathy's mom would give her money to also pick up toothpaste while she was running her errands, and Kathy's dad would drop her off at the corner of Forest and Cumberland Avenues around 1 p.m. Kathy was seen headed east towards Congress Avenue, where she stopped in nearby stores. Around 3 p.m., Kathy would go into a local music store and meet up with her friend from school, Carol Starbird. The two talked about the dance and caught up on gossip for a bit. Kathy was eager to get home and to get on her outfit she had been so excited about and to get ready for the dance. Kathy mentioned to Carol that she had spent her bus fare earlier, so she was going to walk home. It was about a 2-mile walk from the music store. Kathy said goodbye to Carol, promising to meet up with her at the dance, and headed out the store towards Forest Avenue. As she disappeared into the distance, that would be the last time she was ever seen by a loved one. At 6 p.m., when Kathy hadn't returned for dinner, like always, and she hadn't called to say she would be late, her family knew something wasn't right. Kathy's father, Roy, decided to go drive the streets looking for her while her mother, Claire, stayed home, calling friends and neighbors in hopes someone had seen Kathy or knew where she was. Kim remembers the mood shifting from frustration to concern, then alarm, and that's when her parents would call the police. Roy would head out to the station to speak with an officer in person. An officer would tell Roy that it was too soon to be filing a missing person report and that Kathy had probably just run away, and to call again when more time had passed. The officer had a condescending and indifferent attitude about the whole situation, but Roy felt deep in his gut that his daughter was in danger. That feeling would haunt him for the rest of his life. The next day, Kathy's parents convinced the police department to file a missing person report that went largely unnoticed. October 5th, 10 days after Kathy went missing, the Press Herald and Evening Express ran stories about Kathy and both her parents pleading with the public for any information to contact them or the police. 5 days later, October 10th, the Maine Sunday Telegram's headline read, "Police Hunt in Vain for Missing Girls." The article covered both Kathy and 11-year-old Barbara Ann Ripley's disappearance. Barbara had gone missing after her school bus dropped her off in North Yarmouth, and the communities were frustrated with these young girls' disappearance. Barbara's remains would be found 10 years later in a box barn. Police believe she ran away and died due to the elements. I'd like to take a deeper look into that one myself. Youth Aid Bureau Officer Russell Norris told the reporter of the Telegram that the search for Kathy was at a standstill. He said, quote, "We've checked out every clue, but nothing. We just don't know what happened. She just dropped from sight," unquote. There would be rumors about Kathy's disappearance in the neighborhood and her school, saying that she ran away to Boston, but there was never any evidence that pointed to that. Kathy's mother would sit in their sun parlor for hours on end, staring out the window, watching and waiting for Kathy to come home, walking up the street. Eventually, they would hire their own private detective to help them look for Kathy. In November, after Thanksgiving, Kathy's family would receive a tip that Kathy was seen in, and don't come at me, I'm trying to pronounce these cities, Presque Isle. Her parents would make the 4-hour drive north and meet with the local police, who told them that they didn't know about their missing daughter. They would hand out missing posters with Kathy's description and a photo in town, and that would lead to another tip that a girl matching Kathy's description was seen in New Brunswick. Her family would head to New Brunswick, but again would find another dead end and decide to return home to Portland to continue their search. Officials would go to Deering High School and clean out Kathy's locker in hopes of finding a clue. It's there that they would find a 7-digit phone number on a scrap of paper, hoping that this was a new lead. But after looking further into the number, they discovered it was just the number of her father's used car shop. They decided her locker was another dead end. The family's investigation stalled, and it seemed police were not investigating at all. It would be decades before police decided to look deeper into this case and try to piece together evidence and begin the real search effort for Kathy. The attitude in the 70s about missing kids were they were not missing, but they had run off to join experimental communities, were protesting, rebelling, or in the case of young girls, they just decided to run off with their boyfriends if they were drafted. There was no major news coverage for Kathy's case back then, and with no social media platforms, her case went widely unnoticed by the public. 3.5 years after Kathy's disappearance, her sister Kim would turn 16. She knew that this was a hard milestone for her parents, for their middle child to reach the same age as their oldest child when she disappeared. Kim herself would avoid going to the YWCA for dances that Kathy loved. It was just too painful for everyone. It really altered Kim's reality on a daily. Part of her persona became to protect herself from danger every time she walked out the door. The very real reality that the world was more dangerous than she had known before her sister disappeared was now her new normal. It would be 17 years after Kathy went missing when in 1988 her family would hear a knock at the door to find Detective William Deachin on their doorstep. Detective Deachin was working with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to help identify remains of a murder victim found in Surrey, British Columbia, to see if perhaps the remains were Kathy's. It was the first real lead they had in Kathy's case. Now, how they connected those dots or what made them think it could be Kathy, I don't know. But now, someone was paying attention to her case. They would collect Kathy's dental records to compare and discover that the remains were not Kathy, since she had very distinctive work done on her teeth before getting her braces, and these did not match the victim's. It would be another 3 years before there would be any movement on Kathy's case. In 1995, recently promoted Detective Caddy would be given a cold case file assigned by Sergeant Thomas Joyce with one single page in it. It was the missing report filed on Kathy, September 25th, 1971. He would also be handed an investigation supplement written up by Detective Deachin, dated January 15th, 1988, as the last date that showed work logged on Kathy's case. Detective Caddy looked at this file that day, and from that day on, this became the case he wouldn't let go of. Detective Caddy decided to start his investigation from the beginning. First, he reached out to Kathy's best friend, Nancy Barlow. After talking with her and the photographer, Chris Church, Detective Caddy would learn about Kathy's then-boyfriend, Lester. As he dug deeper into the day of Kathy's disappearance, they would find a witness that had come forward in November 1971 that said she saw Kathy getting into a blue car with two men on September 24th. Later on, Detective Caddy would find out that Lester had actually picked up a Canadian man in his late 20s and offered to drive him to Topeke Reservation outside of Perth Andover, north of Brunswick, the same day that Kathy was seen getting into that blue car. He doesn't believe Kathy knew about this man and his plans when she got in that car. As Detective Caddy looked deeper into Lester's background, he would discover that Lester was a suspect in a vehicle theft in 1963 of a four-door blue Cadillac stolen from the owner of the Davis Motel on Route 1 in Falmouth, where Lester had worked. Along with the stolen car, there was a report that a credit card in the car was missing as well. Miss Davis, the owner of the car and credit card, would receive a statement a month later from that stolen card with a charge at Dorsey's Garage in Fairfield for four tires. When Detective Caddy followed that trail, it led him to Don Logan, an employee of Dorsey Garage, who remembers seeing Kathy with two men when they came to purchase four tires for the Cadillac. He specifically remembers the man that he identified as the Canadian man Lester was traveling with, escorting Kathy to and from the bathroom with his hand resting on the back of Kathy's neck as if to control all of her movements. Detective Caddy would follow that lead to the reservation, where witnesses told him that they had seen Kathy on the reservation for a few days in September 1971 before they headed to McBride's farm in Mars Hill to harvest potatoes. A woman named Millie Augustine from New Brunswick, who was close to Kathy's age at the time, was in Mars Hill, and she said she saw Kathy there. Millie said that Kathy used her own name, but was afraid of the men on the farm. She cried a lot, and she wanted to go home. She said Kathy spent most of her time in the back seat of the Cadillac, where Millie's dad would bring her food to eat for dinner. Millie said one night Lester and Kathy left the farm alone. Lester would return without Kathy the next morning and tell Millie that he had dropped Kathy off at another camp. Detective Caddy was able to put together that Lester actually brought Kathy back to the reservation and left her with the man that they had traveled with. Lester then finished working the potato harvest and then headed south to pick oranges. Lester would never return to live in Maine and would die at 35 of cancer in 1986. Detective Cowdy does believe that Lester did drop Kathy off with his travel companion in New Brunswick and that he never saw her again, nor knew what happened to her after that. Detective Cowdy kept pushing to put the pieces together and try to figure out what happened to Kathy after she was dropped at New Brunswick. Detective Cowdy and Sergeant Joyce would join forces with the FBI, U.S. Marshals, the RCMP, and the Reservation Police to help find and interview any witnesses. There were many who were reluctant to talk, but particularly the man who had been with Kathy in 1971. I don't know why they don't share his identity and continue just to refer to him as the Canadian Traveler. But that's where we are. In 1996, an investigative grand jury in Cumberland County looked into the now 25-year-old case, and the Canadian man who had been with Kathy was the main focus on that investigation. However, they didn't have enough evidence to charge him with anything. The Canadian Traveler refused to cooperate, but Detective Cowdy and Sergeant Joyce together found enough evidence that they believe shows that Kathy died on the reservation sometime before Thanksgiving in 1971. They have heard rumors that her body is buried in the basement of the man's family home or near a trail in the area. However, there's not been enough evidence for them to get a warrant to search for her remains. This Canadian man, who has never been named and was never officially named a suspect, was offered immunity from prosecution if he would just provide investigators with any details about what happened to Kathy, but he refused to talk. This man still lives in Canada today and has served time in prison for rape and home invasion charges. In the summer of 1999, Detective Cowdy would drive down to Kathy's parents' home and sit them down to explain to them what he had learned and what they believe happened to Kathy. Ray didn't want to believe it. He said, "I always want to keep my mind open. I'm going to hope you're wrong, and she's going to show up and come through that door." Her mother, Claire, told Detective Cowdy that even after a quarter century, she still sits in that sunroom every day, watching and waiting for her daughter to come home. Kathy's family never stopped pushing for Kathy. They never stopped talking about her. In 2017, her father, Roy, died at 92 without the answers he so desperately searched for. And Claire is now in her early 90s and is a great-grandmother. She wasn't available for a recent interview with a journalist, but I personally believe she is still sitting in that sunroom, watching out the window, waiting for Kathy. And for as far as where the case is today, it's still open. There's no officially named suspects. They also continue to conceal the Canadian man's identity, which I find extremely frustrating, but I have to believe that they have a reason behind it. Detective Cowdy welcomes Kathy's case being spoken about because every time her story is told, they seem to get some new information. Kathy's family said at this point they are not on a quest of justice. They don't have the fight in the heart left for that. They just want the answers. They have hope that eventually people will feel safe to come forward with the missing pieces they need. At this point, they know there are people out there with information. They know there's probably lots of people aware of what happened to Kathy. They are just afraid to speak up. They just want to bring her home to rest, to give her a proper burial. Kathy's family continues to keep the memory of Kathy alive in their life. They tell stories to their grandchildren and talk about what they did as kids together. Kim said that she knows some people find it more comfortable to bury that pain and not talk about it, but not them. They'll never stop talking about Kathy. And they'll never stop pushing for answers. You know, I always say we should tell these stories again and again. And Detective Cowdy and her sister Kim say there's proof that it works. They continue to tell us that every time her story is told, they find another bit of information. So if you want to help in Kathy's case, in any case, then please keep telling their stories, share their posts, and continue to support the families looking for answers. As always, remember, when you see those missing and murdered posts, to share, like, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.